Hello everyone, you're listening to a new episode of the CCYSC Awaaz podcast. I'm Asthauri, pursuing Masters in Education, Early Childhood Care and Education at Ambedkar University, Delhi, India, and have been interned with CCYSC to understand better education, particularly in terms of childhood and youth. Today we have with us Yamila Rodriguez. She is a lawyer by profession. She is also a PhD researcher at the University of Buenos Aires. Her research topic is children's right to participation in criminal courts. She has also worked as a court clerk at criminal court in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Her key research interests are human rights, child right, autonomy, child-friendly justice, access to justice, psychology of the testimony. Thank you, Ms. Yamila Rodriguez, to be with us on this platform of CCYSC Awaaz podcast. It is a pleasure having you over here and having a conversation with you to understand child rights better. And we shall start. So, hi Yamila.
Hi Asta. Hi everyone. Huh. Thank you for having me here.
It is an honor to have you on the board of CCYSC Awaaz podcast, and I shall start. So I would like to know that how did you went into this field of child rights, basically? So what are the child rights that, you know, we are going to understand? We understand child rights in the sense that children should also have rights, but what rights children should have? Do they have the rights to question to their parents and everything? So, yes.
Okay, thank you. And yes, how did I get into this field? Well, as you've said, I am a lawyer and I've been working in a criminal court in Buenos Aires for many years now. So my research interest, which is specifically child victims and witnesses and their rights pertaining the justice system, comes from my academic training in human rights. I have a master's in human rights, but also from my work at the criminal court. And this is because I, while dealing with children and child victims, I came to realize that children's voices were silenced in justice procedures and that they were like invisible in important events that were happening to them.
All right, thank you for that, Yamila. Now the next question that I'm going to proceed with is, what are human rights?
Okay, thank you. This is a good starting point. First of all, it is, I think, important to differentiate what is the concept of human rights from what is international human rights law. Conceptually, human rights are rights possessed by all human beings, irrespective of any particularities, such as race, sex, nationality, ethnicity, language, religion, age, or any other status. Also, human rights constitute standards of behavior that all societies ought to respect, regardless of their particular constitutional arrangements, conceptions of justice, or vernacular conventions. And when governments violate human rights, they not merely infringe their moral obligations, but harm individual human beings as well. So basically, everyone is entitled to these rights because of their human condition. Also, human rights are norms aimed at preserving and promoting certain salient features, capacities, or interests attached to our human standing, such as autonomy, the capacity for purposive agency, or the conditions for leading a distinctive human life. But legally speaking, international human rights law lays down the obligations of government to act in certain ways or to refrain from certain acts in order to promote and protect, what I said before, human rights and fundamental freedoms of individuals, of groups. Human rights violations by states, according to international law, may justify the adoption of remedial measures by the international community. And as you probably know, there is an enormous body of human rights law. Some of these international instruments are universal, like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Other instruments are regional, like the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights or the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. And as I've said before, also human rights law covers a wide range of subjects. We have civil and political rights, which include, for example, the right to freedom of expression and the prohibition of torture. These are the first generation of rights. There are also economic, social, and cultural rights, such as the right to health and the right to education, which are second generation. And finally, there are third generation rights. These rights include the right to a healthy environment, the right to participation in cultural heritage, among others. Human rights treaties can also be classified according to their beneficiaries. For example, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and that I've mentioned before, and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's specifically directed to children.
All right, that was really nice, Yamala. Thank you for that. So now my preceding question to this would be, do children have human rights? What are major debates on this matter, and what are the implications according to you?
Okay, thank you. This is an interesting question. I'll start with the question about do children have human rights? And if we consider that, as I said at the beginning, human rights are rights possessed by all human beings, irrespective of any particularities, then the answer is, of course, yes. Children are human beings, so they must have human rights. However, this has not always been the case. For most of human history, children, like other vulnerable groups, such as women, were not considered as full subjects of law. Their voices and needs were not a matter of political debate. Children did not belong to the public world. They were relegated to the private, domestic world. They were also considered as property of the father or the family or community. It depends on the part of the world we are. Institutions started paying attention to children during the 19th century. Children had always been labor force in farms and households. And however, after the Industrial Revolution, they were specially employed at factories and mines, often working long hours in dangerous jobs for low pay. At the same time, in this period, many people emigrated to the cities, searching for jobs, bringing their children with them to live, in most cases, in miserable conditions. As a result, there were a lot of children wandering in the streets, suffering malnutrition and all kinds of diseases. So the exploitation in the workplace and the poor living condition of children in the streets got the attention of middle and upper classes. Philanthropists started campaigning towards child protection. Children were brought to special institutions. They were given an educational care. The idea was to take children out of the streets, and street children were considered dangerous. Therefore, the beginning of the children's rights movement was based on the right to special protection and had paternalistic features. This protectionist approach towards children and young people was kept out of legal regulations. Children were sent to institutions without a proper procedure. The idea behind this was that they were helping children. It was a good thing, so there was nothing to regulate. However, at the beginning of the 20th century, many thinkers and influential people around the world started questioning this protectionist approach. Yes, children need to be protected because they are in a vulnerable situation due to their age. They lack experience and they need to be guided and accompanied as they develop into fully capable human beings. But they are human beings, and as such, they are entitled to all the human rights catalog, not only the rights to protection. Eventually, this led to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child in 1989. This instrument has four principles: the best interest of the child, non-discrimination, special protection, and participation. The convention contains a wide range of rights covering the three generations of rights and is the most important children's rights document of the world. And regarding the major debates on this matter, I think that considering children as rights holders has many consequences in many different fields. For example, regarding children's autonomy, there are many interesting debates going on at the moment, mainly regarding medical decisions, gender identity, reproductive rights. However, I would like to mention three implications that I consider to be the most important ones. The first one has to do with child protection systems. These systems, according to the convention, must be designed respecting the four principles. The best interest of the child must be evaluated on an individual basis. We cannot regulate for the children in general. We have to think about the child in particular we are dealing with. And children's opinions must be considered in all matters affecting them. They must be able to participate in the decisions that are adopted, like adoption or custody, or who are they going to live with. Basically, they are entitled to have a say in what is going to happen to them. Another important debate still going on in children's rights is related to juvenile justice. One of the biggest achievements of the CRC was the difference between protection systems and criminal responsibility systems. Before, the public response to abandoned or neglected children was the same as the response to child offenders. According to the CRC, children have the right to due process, they must be kept separated from others, and they should be heard throughout the process. Also, there are still disagreements about which should be the minimum age of criminal responsibility. In some countries, it is 16. In others, it's 14. There are countries that still with 12. So there's still a lot going on with juvenile justice and age of criminal responsibility. And the last implication I would like to refer to is regarding child victims. The main target of children's rights used to be street children at the beginning of the movement. Nowadays, it is children who are victims of violence in a broad sense. A big issue these days is about children in the move, migrant children, and children who are victims of human trafficking. In my opinion, the biggest challenge concerning child victims is ensuring that their voices are heard and considered. Not only because it is their human right to participate, but also in a more philosophical approach, because I think that giving children the possibility to choose and express their opinions will have a broader impact on society. Children who learn to express themselves as autonomous subjects will have more chances to grow up to be free and responsible citizens. So I think that this question is ready.
Thank you so much for that, Ms. Yamila. So to that preceding question, I would just like to ask you, what are the main challenges to human rights activists and organizations with regard to children and their access to justice? As we also talked about that how justice needs to be served to children, basically juveniles as well, and our children prone to a lot of injustice in the society and basically in the Latin America?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. As I've been saying, the main challenge to children's rights to access to justice is related to paying attention to what children have to say about the events that occur in their lives. We as adults have to learn to listen to children's voices. And why is it important? Because no one knows better what a child needs than the child himself or herself. Of course, as children are in a vulnerable situation because of their lack of experience, they must be protected and guided in their interactions with judicial institutions. We must remember that even very young children can express themselves. Maybe not through language, but they can play, draw, perform, interact with objects. Even crying or hiding under a table is a way of expressing themselves and should be given due importance according to the CRC principles. it's important to remember that according to the CRC, children have evolving capacities. This means that while growing up, they will gradually require less guidance and have more autonomy. So their opinions and the way they interact with the systems must be viewed in light of this principle too. That they won't understand the questions on their or that they will lie to the court. In this regard, we should consider that children's legal status has both protective and participatory elements. A justice system that is respectful of children's rights must consider not only children's particular situation in society, the situation of vulnerability that I have indicated earlier, but also their agency and capability to exercise their rights in a manner consistent with their capacities, evolving capacities. There is a very interesting concept, the concept of justice adapted to children or child-friendly justice. Child-friendly justice aims to make justice systems more focused on the rights of children who come into contact with justice and systems related as victims, witnesses, or suspected offenders, or for other reasons where intervention is required, for example, immigration process. The idea is to build a justice system that is more sensitive to children's interest and more responsive to children's participation in formal and informal decision making concerning them. A rights-based justice model must have an impact on the procedures adopted by a court beyond ensuring adequate representation of a child in a process. It should extend to all aspects of the proceedings. For example, the way a child provides evidence, the duration of the session day, where and with whom the child will sit, the physical arrangement of the court itself, the extent to which the public has access to the court, and the eventual publication of any procedures of the media.
Thank you for that, Yamila. That was really helpful. To that, I had a preceding question. What are the international human rights instruments which Latin America have signed or have rectified with terms of, you know, human rights or basically the child rights that we can understand?
Yes. In Latin America in general, and specifically in my country, in Argentina, we have signed almost all the human rights treaties, the universal ones, and there are some regional conventions that also apply to children. For example, of course, we are part of the CRC, but also the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights has a special provision. It's Article 19 of the convention that that specifically states that children should children have a right to special protection, and that is the provision that the court, the Inter-American Court, uses to address children's rights in their competence.
Thank you for that insight, Yamila. To that, I would have a preceding question. Does children's rights to participation means that children can tell their parents what to do?
Well, that is an interesting question, Asta. I don't think that children's rights to participation means that we or anyone will do what children want. I think that the right to participation has basically two implications. One is that there must be an environment and the conditions to listen to children and to make to make it available for them to share their opinions. So in any procedure or in any decision that is going to be taken that affects them, they should be asked what they think, what is their opinion on the matter. And that opinion should be given due importance. I mean, I think that is the most important thing, that it's not only listening, like, okay, I'm going to ask the children what they think about what is going on, but also taking into account that, and then sharing the result of the decision with them, explaining it to them, make it a participatory process. And the second implication, I think, has to do with the process itself of making decisions. So they won't tell their parents what to do, but they should decide with their parents what is going to be done when it's something that affects them. Of course, this should have the, as an exception, let's say, a situation that may harm the child. But in any other case, I think that participation implies making them a part of the decision in any subject that affects them. It can be a situation at home, a situation at the school, sports club, and even in public institutions.
Thank you for that, Yamila. That was really helpful. Now, attaining to that question, I would like to ask you about how do you persist black children's participation in the anti-racist campaigns? As we have seen, all over the America, how have blacks' life affected? So, what is your say with terms of human rights on this?
Yeah, I really like this question. Thank you, Asta. Youth activism is everywhere now. Black people, black youth activism is everywhere in the news these days, but actually it's not new. Think about the student movement of the 1960s or 70s. And for some young people, it was about climate change recently. For others, it's about gun violence. Now it's about Black People's Matter. So young people are bringing awareness to societal crises all around the world. And as I've said, historically, this is really nothing new. Young people have long been leaders and catalysts of important movements. Unfortunately, these change makers are often thought to be outside of what it is considered typical of these age groups. We can also think that it's also about power. If adults let children take the lead in this activism, they will probably lose their own places there. So I think that as a consequence of this power struggle, young people are often labeled problematic, selfish, or not yet ready to lead. However, children are being protagonists of change all around the world. For example, in my own country, in Argentina, we have seen how young women and girls are a fundamental part of the feminist movement that is fighting for abortion and reproductive rights. Also, 2 years ago, there was a massive student strike in Buenos Aires against the project to reform the educational system, and it made an impact. So I think that there is still a lot to study about youth activism. We still have to see also what happens when the lockdown measures are really over. One preliminary conclusion we can draw is that children are using a variety of tactics, for example, digital tools, and in that they take the lead. So and it's an interesting way to demonstrate their engagement in activism and resistance. And as we continue to see the presence and the proliferation of this dynamic displays of protest, it is necessary that we begin to explore how these forms of innovative engagement interact with political engagement and what are the results. In my opinion, when young people are involved in activism, they're likely to feel a stronger sense of personal agency in their communities and in the larger world. And I think that supporting youth activism, and especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, is supporting a thriving democracy and more informed, responsible, and caring citizens.
Thank you. That was really helpful. Can I also ask you about what have been, you know, the issues related to child education with terms of the child rights, if we talk about, you know, and the educational related strikes that we have seen all over, you know, in America, basically, in Argentina as well, in your own country?
Yes. The education strikes had to do with a reform that or different reforms going on in different countries pertaining the change of the system. For example, there were not going to be teachers in many subjects. They were going to have like instructors or orientors, or there were also going to be internships for young people in the last years of high school, which at first sight you may say, okay, this is wonderful, they will have some work experience, but one have to remember that we are dealing with societies that have suffered and are still suffering complicated situations in the economic field, and there's always an economic crisis going on. So many young people are in need of jobs, like paid jobs. So that was one of the biggest claims, like, okay, it's good to have work experience, but now we are going to be free labor force. So I think that draw attention to a very interesting question regarding education, and it has to do with work, with working activities, like job related ones. And I'm not referring to training. I am referring to working, because historically children used to work from a very young age, and there's nothing wrong in working. What is wrong is to be exploited, and what is wrong is not to have time to learn and to play and to do all the other things. But it is not wrong to work when you are when you have an age that when you are, for example, 16 or 17, if you work for a few hours, or if you have your own pocket money to do whatever you want. So especially in societies like Latin America, you have to think about that and listen to what they are asking and what is the strike connected to. And for example, they were occupying the schools, no, the schools building, and there were some big notices that said, "Please don't judge us, and just ask us what we are asking for." And it was interesting, because not many people were involved with what was going on with children. Like, they were seen as rebel, as troublemakers, and that the education system should be designed by the authorities and not by children. And as I was saying before, who else but children know what they want to do? Of course, they need to be guided, but I think that it's that society is losing, is missing a big opportunity to learn more about the future when children's voices are silent.
Thank you. That was really, really helpful, Yamila. And to that, I would just, want to understand, what are the institutional mechanisms or authorities available for monitoring or protecting rights of the children?
The institutions, well, we have at the universal level, we have the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which is the body of independent experts that monitors the implementation of the CRC by state parties. And what is interesting with the Committee on the Rights of the Child pertaining protection is that nowadays the committee has three optional protocols. The first optional protocol was about the sale of children, child prostitution, and child pornography. The second one was about the involvement of children in armed conflict. But the third one, which I think it's 2014, is about the communications procedure. And it's interesting because this optional protocol allows communications to be submitted by a child or on behalf of a child or a group of children claiming to be victims of a violation by a state party of any of the rights set forth in the CRC or its two optional protocols. And in the protocol, there is a quite curious provision. It says that the committee shall be guided by the principle of the best interest of the child. And the protocol also states that the committee shall also have regard for the rights and views of the child, the views of the child being given due weight in accordance with the age and maturity of the child. And why is it curious? Because who, if not the Committee on the Rights of the Child, should listen to children? I mean, yes, it had to be stated expressly that children's views should be given due weight. So this shows that children's rights to be heard should not be taken for granted at any level, because the most important body that protects children still had to state it clearly that, okay, children should be listened to. And of course, there are a lot of national institutions like the Ombudsman for Children in almost every country its main objective is to protect children in the public discussions or children interests in the public discussions or to incorporate the children's rights approach to public policies, national public policies. And there are also very good initiatives regarding, for example, child-friendly justice in the Council of Europe, in the European system, which I think are really interesting because there was a youth consultation process to design them. So that is a good way of incorporating child views to the public policy.
Thank you so much. That was really, really helpful, Yamila. To that, a preceding question and the last question for that to wrap up with this podcast. In terms of talking to children, and we have been talking about children's rights and everything, who do you think are the most vulnerable children in you know, the age group of children who are, you know, basically who have child rights? Who are the most vulnerable children?
Thank you, Asta. I think that the most vulnerable children nowadays, the age group, probably are the adolescents. I think that they are now dealing with a new world. Of course, this was aggravated with the pandemic and all that, but the digital risks have been around for many years now. So I think that there's a big awareness concerning early childhood and early childhood protections, and I think that of course they are still vulnerable and there are many problems regarding, for example, malnutrition around the world or lack of education, and it's a serious problem. But I think that one of the most vulnerable groups nowadays are the adolescents and the digital world, and it's going to be hard for them to to change, I think, the world in a new way, and it's going to be their responsibility. So I think they are in a vulnerable situation now because they are, in most cases, isolated and they don't have contact with their peers for many months now. So I think that after the COVID-19 pandemic, they will be in a more vulnerable situation than other age groups.
Thank you so much for that, Yamila, and thank you for sparing out your time to have a discussion with us on, you know, child rights and understanding how child rights have been working across globe and everything. This was a really helpful podcast to understand what is a child and, you know, what are the protections that a child need. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Asta, for having me here. It was a pleasure.